From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Russia cuts off natural gas deliveries to Poland and Bulgaria as one of Vladimir Putin's generals lets slip his plan for Ukraine. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial board member Alicia Finley. Welcome to you both. On Tuesday, Russia's energy giant Gazprom moved to cut off natural gas supplies to two NATO members, Poland and Bulgaria. This is the first time that Vladimir Putin has made good on his threats to use energy as a weapon against NATO members, European Union members. That gas to those countries typically comes via a pipeline that runs from northern Russia through Belarus and to Poland. Poland's climate minister is saying that, quote, we are ready to be fully cut off from Russian gas. Bulgaria's energy ministry says that there's no restrictions that are required on gas consumption at the moment. And we have a clip here from Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission.
Today, the Kremlin failed once again in his attempt to sow division among member states. The era of Russian fossil fuel in Europe is coming to an end. Europe is moving forward on energy issues.
That is quite a statement. The era of Russian fossil fuel use in Europe is coming to an end. And most of Germany's gas supplies from Russia come through a different pipeline, the Nord Stream pipeline under the Baltic Sea. And Kim, as far as the last reports that I've seen, that energy was still flowing, but who knows about tomorrow?
Right. So just to look at these two countries that have been cut off, they're in different situations. So in Poland, they were already on track to be independent of Russian energy by the end of the year. And they have said that they have plans now to replace what's being cut off by more liquefied natural gas, ramping up local production, and getting more supplies from Norway via a Baltic pipeline. The situation is much worse for Bulgaria, which gets about three quarters of its gas from Russia. And while it's debating getting more gas through an existing pipeline to Greece, trying to bring a new pipeline on to Greece that would allow it to get gas from Azerbaijan, it doesn't have as many options just right now. The obvious thing here, it looks as though Russia is trying to send a message. It obviously had told everyone last month, you have to pay in rubles. This is an attempt to shore up their own currency and to force some engagement with their banking system, which had otherwise been cut off. This seems to be a shot over the bow at Europe, saying that because Europe had been debating an oil embargo, maybe to put some pressure on Sofia, the Bulgarians, who have yet to decide whether or not they're going to supply arms to Ukraine. But it's also a very scary prospect for countries like Germany and Italy, the really big gas users, who it sounds as though they're determined, but they're also in a tougher spot in terms of what they can do. They're reducing their gas imports. And somewhat quickly, I was amazed to see that Germany's gas imports from Russia are already down to 35% from 55% at the beginning of this conflict. So they're making some changes, but there's only so much that can be done in the short term.
One silver lining is that this cutoff did not happen a few months ago in the dead of winter. I checked the weather in Warsaw, Poland, and it's saying that it's a high of 62 today and low of 40 tonight, which is a little bit chilly, but nothing compared to what it was a few months ago. So from a home heating perspective, there's less risk than there might have been. But of course, we also know that all sorts of industrial processes and businesses also rely on natural gas. And so, Alicia, I keep coming back to this question of what could the U.S. do? And my understanding is that there are a dozen and a half liquefied natural gas terminals that are proposed for construction in the United States. Can we not get some kind of Operation Warp Speed and President Biden, with some federal leadership here, announce that we intend to get them built by winter and treat it as a national security issue? I mean, remember that these are NATO allies we're talking about.
So there are about 20 or so, that many of which have, by the way, already been permitted by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Many of those were done under Trump. Some of them are still waiting for DOE sign-offs. The Department of Energy has to certify that the liquefied natural gas exports aren't, quote unquote, the public interest. So it has to do a separate review, which can take a year or two. Obviously, I think one of the things that I've heard being floated in Congress is to automatically deem any exports to a NATO ally or an ally in general to be in the public interest. I think that that's something Congress should do immediately. It would require an act of legislation. Obviously, the Department of Energy could also just fast track these on its own. But, you know, it's been kind of dawdling on this. You know, the Biden administration, even while it says that it wants to help Europe wean itself off Russian gas, it really hasn't done anything besides make this big announcement that, you know, by 2030, it's going to help provide Europe with supposedly 50 billion cubic feet of natural gas through liquefied or LNG exports. But how do you get that, right? You're going to need more pipelines. You're going to need more export facilities. We're running full steam right now on our export facilities. We really can't export any more than we are already doing. The soonest another one of the LNG plants that's now currently under construction probably won't be done until sometime next year. So right now we're running full speed. These new ones that have been proposed and some of which have been approved by FERC, those will and can increase our capacity, but it'll take a couple of years just to build them. But we have to realize the conflict with Russia weaponizing its gas, that's not going to stop. Right now, Putin has shown, and I think, you know, it's a warning to Europe, another warning if it needed it, that, you know, Russia is going to use its energy, continue to use its energy supply, not just against, you know, Ukraine, but also, you know, against NATO countries. And because, to be honest, it's his strongest weapon. It's his strongest economic weapon.
Well, I take the point that these are complicated facilities that can't be set up overnight. But I still find myself wondering that if we had some federal leadership, some presidential leadership, whether we could get these things done and built and moving LNG to Europe faster than we normally otherwise would, maybe not quite by winter, maybe by the middle of the winter, early next year. And what about Congress's role here, which Alicia raises? Kim, I mean, is this something that would be potentially part of a deal that Republicans could make with West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin? Reportedly, he is interested again in some kind of climate package with some energy infrastructure reforms embedded in it. And remember, if you're going to set up these terminals, you also need the LNG infrastructure to go with it, including pipelines that would feed those facilities. So, Kim, do you think there's any hope for a bipartisan package here, or are the other things that Joe Manchin wants, including higher taxes, going to break any deal with the GOP?
Yeah, so it depends on the contours of that package. And the good news, by the way, about Senator Joe Manchin is that he does understand energy reality. He's been very forceful in his party in pushing back against those who want to simply turn off the switch to fossil fuels, saying that it's ridiculous, that it's not safe, that we need to care about reliability, and that natural gas in particular is a bridge fuel. He often makes the case that the market is doing far more to transition away to cleaner energy like natural gas than anything Congress has been doing. Now, he has suggested that there might be the grounds to do some sort of what people are calling a skinny energy package, very much focused on simply energy provisions and not a lot of the other junk that Democrats were debating in their bill back better agenda. He said he wants to do it in a bipartisan and bicameral fashion, meaning he'd like it to look much like they did with infrastructure, in which you had Republicans and Democrats in both the Senate and the House. I think that there's a number of obstacles to that, which you just pointed out. One of them is one other thing that Joe Manchin cares a lot about right now is raising taxes. Would that be part of this deal in order to fund some of the government provisions in an energy deal? Republicans would likely want more in terms of LNG, natural gas, simply freeing up production. But Democrats on their side would undoubtedly want more money for charging terminals for electric cars and other things that cost government dollars. How do you pay for that? That was obviously a problem with the infrastructure package as well, where they ended up coming up with a bunch of kind of phony pay-fors. The more obvious way to get that dollar value now is to instead just raise taxes, which is a priority of Manchin's. And at the moment, I simply do not see Republicans going for that, especially if there's a midterm in the offing. Nobody wants to be on record on the Republican side as being a tax hiker.
Well, perhaps there's room for some of these provisions then in a funding package for more Ukraine aid. President Biden has said that he is about hit the limit of his authority to spend money to send weapons and other aid to Ukraine, and he's going to need Congress to take some action. Maybe there's room for it in there. And Alicia, the other thing I would point out is that a huge increase in American LNG exports would be a big climate win over the status quo. And I don't expect to persuade progressives on that point. But as it happens, some of the reports on this move on natural gas in Europe today suggest that Poland burns coal for most of its electricity. And if that could be some sort of package deal, some incentive, we'll help Poland convert some of its plants to natural gas plants, set up new ones, and we will promise to feed them our natural gas. That would be a huge carbon cut. And I don't see why that couldn't be part of the argument for Biden to make.
Well, right. So coal is much more carbon intensive. It also, emits a lot of other pollutants that natural gas doesn't or does in lesser amounts. Actually, a lot of power plants are set up to switch between coal and gas. So when you see it happen, when gas prices rise, like which has been happening in Europe. I mean, they've been surging. I think right now they're about half of what they were a month or so ago. But when gas prices rise, power plants switch to burning coal, which is, not great for the environment. And to the extent that the left cares about the climate and greenhouse gas emissions, it just increases greenhouse gas emissions, right? So what I think Poland, one of the reasons why it doesn't have to worry so much about this gas cut off from Russia is because it's just going to be burning more coal, which should actually maybe potentially free up some more gas supply for the rest of Europe. But in the long term, I think you're right that more LNG exports from the U.S. will help reduce coal demand or coal consumption worldwide, which will have a much greater impact than any kind of renewable, splurge in the U.S. I've heard that just the U.S. LNG gas exports in the last 5 or so years, when the first LNG terminal came online, have, more than offset any kind of renewables contribution to the U.S.'s declining greenhouse gas emissions, which is pretty incredible if you think about it. I interviewed EQT's largest U.S. natural gas producer in the country the other week, and he pointed out that just basically doubling LNG exports or increasing, or sorry, not doubling, but 50% would be the equivalent of basically electrifying every car on the road, building 54,000 wind turbines in the U.S., which is really should be the left's climate solution, is more LNG rather than just, focusing entirely on renewables, which will never get them to where they want to go in terms of moving to a quote-unquote net zero world. You're going to have gas as a quote-unquote bridge fuel, and probably going to be a very long bridge, to be honest.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. My other thought about this Russian energy cutoff is I wonder whether it will harden Europe's resolve to defend Ukraine if they see Putin use the energy weapon that he has been threatening to use all along. And it's notable in recent days, Germany has reversed its position on sending heavy weapons. So the status quo was that Germany had decided that it would help Slovenia give Ukraine some Soviet-era tanks, and then Germany would replace Slovenia's tanks. That was the plan. And then on Tuesday, we have some news. Here's the CNN opening. Germany has agreed to deliver anti-aircraft tanks to Ukraine. The German defense minister said, "We decided yesterday that we will support Ukraine with anti-aircraft systems, which is exactly what Ukraine needs now to secure the airspace from the ground." And Kim, this is the first time that Germany is providing that kind of heavy weaponry to Ukraine, and looks like it's a change in its total position.
Well, and about time, too. This was becoming an embarrassment for Germany, which is obviously one of the central powers of Europe and had done the least for Ukraine so far among almost everybody else. It had become this almost joke that as other countries were sending over anti-aircraft systems and scouring their bases for equipment that they could get into Ukraine, that Germany sent 5,000 helmets, as well as, you know, it has also sent some rocket-propelled grenades and guns and ammunition, but not much. They had had a number of arguments for this as well, too. Germany has traditionally had a policy of not providing lethal weapons in conflict zones, which goes way, way back through its history to that position. It was worried that by sending real heavy artillery, it might degrade its own military capacity. Although, of course, the answer and response to that is maybe if you'd had invested a little bit more in your military over the years instead of the paltry amounts that Germany has invested, it wouldn't be in this situation. For whatever reason, though, mostly because of pressure, it does seem to have decided to up its game. It's now sending anti-aircraft tanks. Some hope that this is the beginning of a flow that will include other types of heavy artillery. Again, it can't come at a more important time. Ukraine has entered a new phase in this war, in which is simply being pummeled by both the air and the sea by Russian forces, and it's going to need all the heavy artillery we can send to have a chance of retaking some of the ground that Russia has obtained in the east. So it's good to see Germany do this, but we're going to need to do a lot more.
But if everybody is pitching in, that increases the amount of material that is going to these Ukrainian fighters. And there's an interesting op-ed the Journal has today by Bing West. He's a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, also a Marine. And the title is "Ukraine Needs Far More Heavy Weapons." He says the arithmetic of battle in any war is one of large, large numbers. And he points out that the U.S. has committed to giving Ukraine 90 artillery pieces and 144,000 shells. And then he draws some historical comparisons. He says there was a single day in 1944 where there were 18,000 shells that struck a city in Germany. He says that in 1995, there are estimates that Russians fired 4,000 shells an hour in their attack on Grozny. And so the point that he's making is that it is great that the U.S., Germany, and other countries are sending this kind of stuff to these Ukrainian defenders, but they need to keep doing it because an artillery piece doesn't do much good if you don't have the shells to use it, Alicia.
I think that's right. I mean, those numbers that he pointed out in his op-ed were quite striking. Ukraine is going through the shells and artillery like going through toilet paper, okay? You continually need to resupply. The Congress provided some, I guess, $11 billion or so in the last appropriations, the omnibus. But as he points out in his op-ed, basically the Europeans have nations have paid Russia so far nearly $40 billion just for gas, oil, and coal. So far, the U.S. and NATO have only supplied Kyiv about $4 billion in military aid. Now, that's a huge differential. And really, seeing how the war is really going to drag out, and I don't think maybe we will get a ceasefire, maybe we won't sometime in the next couple few months, Ukraine's going to need a lot more. It'll probably need more like $40 billion in military aid rather than just $4 billion. And not all this is obviously going to have to come from the U.S., but, you know, I think everyone, especially Germany, is going to have to chip in more.
And the context here is that Russia and Vladimir Putin are giving no indication that this is coming to a close. And quite the opposite, they're suggesting that their ambitions are even larger than Ukraine. And notable that there was a Russian major general late last week who was quoted by Russian news agencies. And I'll just read part of what he said. "Since the start of the second phase of the special operation, one of the tasks of the Russian army is to establish full control over the Donbas and southern Ukraine This will provide a land corridor to Crimea. That's the peninsula that Russia annexed in 2014. And then he continued to say control over the south of Ukraine is another way out to Transnistria, where there are cases of Russian-speaking people being oppressed, unquote. And Transnistria is a breakaway region of Moldova. So, Kim, what does that say to you about Putin's plan and where he intends to go here if he's able to consolidate control over southern Ukraine?
Well, in case anybody actually ever believed the spin master of the Kremlin, it tells us that, of course, Vladimir Putin has not been truthful from the beginning of this. He has, of course, somewhat hilariously claimed that this was just a special operation to go into Ukraine and try to protect certain Russian-speaking people in the Donbass region and to get rid of supposedly all the Nazis and fascists in Ukraine. This was always ludicrous. People understood that his ambition was to retake Ukraine, reintegrate it into Russia. It was territorial and power ambition. And now this general has lifted the veil and indeed told us that that is exactly what their ambition is, because while they're talking about the priority of strategically taking southern Ukraine and creating this land bridge between Crimea up to Russia, what that really means is that what they hope to do is solidify that support and then regroup, and at the very least go after Transnistria, if not all of Moldova, and potentially launch a new attack to take more of, or all of Ukraine. So no one should think that if the Ukrainians have now beat back Putin from Kiev, that it is somehow some sort of a victory if he only ends up in that piece of Ukraine and creates that land bridge. It's incredibly dangerous. It gives him whole new capacity, as mentioned, to regroup and then to exact his bigger ambitions, which threaten all of Europe. So this gets back to the point about the need to get more equipment and artillery to Ukraine and allow them to, it's going to be hard, it's going to be bloody, but to take back those pieces that Russia has grabbed up to now.
And the risk is that Putin will decide that he wants to wage a wider conflict. And there are some estimates that about a quarter of the population of Latvia is predominantly Russian speaking. And so, Alicia, the question is, what will we be hearing next? Whether Putin needs to free the oppressed Russians of Latvia. I think there's a real risk here that NATO countries and the EU really have an opportunity here to draw the line and say no further.
I think that that's right. And we saw this all going back to 2008 when they had false flag operation in Georgia in South Ossetia. And Putin claimed that he was trying to liberate and protect Russian speakers in that region of Georgia. I think this is going to continue. I mean, you mentioned Latvia. I mean, other Baltic states also have large populations of Russian speakers. And many of them, by the way, aren't necessarily sympathetic to Russia. So the question is, does he move there or does he wait to, you know, first he's probably going to try to, as Kim pointed out, move on Moldova and then consolidate and maybe try to take control of Kiev. But this is by no means, the war is not going to end there. I think Putin does have larger ambitions, especially places where, you know, in the Baltics, where there are strategic energy reserves and ports.
Thank you, Alicia. Thank you, Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. And we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.